We're continuing our study on our covenant relationships, and this is a retake of our session on exchanging belts and weapons. In our previous session, we discussed the practice of exchanging coats, and we discovered that exchanging coats in those days represented giving of oneself to your covenant partner. It represented a shared identity, a shared nature and behavior. Today we're going to talk about exchanging belts and weapons. So what do you suppose exchanging weapons represented? It represented protection, safety, security, and defense. So exchanging weapons showed that one covenant partner was taking on the other's enemies. So when one partner was in danger, it was the other's duty to come to his aid immediately. So the covenant partner pledged himself unto death for the other's security and well-being. That means that each partner was willing to give up their own lives to protect the other partner. They no longer lived independently. They lived for each other. So when anyone came against one partner, they would have to deal with the other partner as well. And each responded to the other person's defense just as quickly and as naturally as he would his own. Now let's consider the significance of exchanging belts. In the ancient days, the belt was larger than today's belts, and it was multifunctional. It held money, it held tools, it held their cloak or armor together, it held their dagger sheath, their sword, their arrow quiver, whatever else they needed to carry. So exchanging belts represented pledging all of one's strength, support, skills, and abilities. So if you were in covenant and in trouble, they're threatened or endangered in any way, your covenant friend, your covenant partner, immediately comes to help you, and vice versa. So that's the significance of exchanging belts and weapons. Now, in our study, we won't actually see the physical exchange of belts and weapons and so forth, but we'll see things in our covenants we're going to be looking at that represent the exchanging of your strength and support and skills and abilities, or providing protection and defense for your other partner. So those are the things we're going to look at in our covenants today. First of all, let's consider God's covenant with Adam and Eve. If we look at Genesis 2, verse 18, this is a possible application. It reads, "The Lord God said, 'It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him.'" Now, the word that's translated helper, the Hebrew word that's translated helper, means an assistant to aid in someone's work, someone who will strengthen the worker. And the word that's translated suitable means pertaining to whatever is in front of him that would require strength or abilities relevant to the particular task at hand. So God provided Adam strength, support, and abilities by doing what? Well, he gave him a wife. He gave him a suitable helper. He called him Eve. He called the helper Eve. And I don't think at this point I need to explain the significance of this to marriage. We're going to look at that in a little bit. But we see that God provided that to Adam by providing Eve. If we look at God's covenant with Noah, look in Genesis 9:2, we see that God is speaking to Noah and his sons, and he says this, "The fear and dread of you will fall upon all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air, upon every creature that moves along the ground, and upon all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hands." So God protected humans from the animals after the flood by doing what? According to this verse, he caused the animals to be afraid of them, so the animals would be less likely to attack them and harm them. Now let's consider God's covenant with Abraham. Again, we're going through these covenants very quickly because I just want to show that this element was present in all of these covenants. So it's really not necessary for us to examine this in depth until we get to ones a little bit later. If we can look at God's covenant with Abraham, it's in Genesis 15:1, we read, "After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision." Now I want to remind you that Abram and Abraham were the same person. Abram was his original name, and Abraham was his covenant name. So after this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward." So God pledged to protect Abram, come to his defense whenever it was needed. So we see protection provided to Abraham through the covenant. Again, this is a covenant provision that we're talking about here. Let's consider God's first covenant with Israel. If we look in Leviticus 26, verses 6, 7, and 8, we read this, "I will grant peace in the land, and you will lie down, and no one will make you afraid. I will remove savage beasts from the land, and the sword will not pass through your country. You will pursue your enemies, and they will fall by the sword before you. 5 of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies will fall by the sword before you." So how does this relate to the practice of exchanging weapons in covenant? We see that God pledged peace to them. He pledged safety from savage animals. He pledged safety from the armies. In other words, he pledged protection to them. Now, as a little side note here, I think it's very interesting to notice some numerical issues in this passage. He said that 5 Israelites would chase 100 of their enemy. Now, that's a pretty good deal as far as I'm concerned. That's a 20-to-1 ratio, that 5 Israelites would chase 100 of their enemy away. But notice it says that 100 Israelites would chase 10,000 of their enemy away. That's a 100-to-1 ratio. Originally, just one of them will chase 20-to-1 ratio, but when there are two or more of them together, they'll chase at 100-to-1 ratio. That's how God works, and we call it synergy. In fact, we see that this is a 5-to-1 increase over what they could do by themselves. In a different passage, I don't recall where the passage reference is, but it talks about one of you put 1,000 to flight and two of you put 10,000 to flight. Well, again, that's a 5-to-1 increase. One will put 1,000, so you expect two to put 2,000, but no, he says two will put 10,000. So that's a 5-to-1 compounding of results. That's synergy. And that's what we see here in Leviticus 26 in God's first covenant to Israel. Let's move on to God's second covenant with Israel. I want to remind you now that the second covenant was after the Israelites had spent 40 years wandering around in the wilderness. Remember, God took them up to the promised land, and he said, this is the first covenant I'm making with you. I want you to enter in and take the promised land. And they refused to do so under God's terms. So God had them wander in the wilderness until that entire generation passed away in the wilderness. So the second generation now, God brings them to the border of the promised land, and he says, I'm making a covenant with you now. And again, the first covenants we see described in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, and the second covenant we see described in Deuteronomy. So let's look at the second covenant, Deuteronomy 7, 22 to 24. The Lord your God will drive out those nations before you little by little. You will not be allowed to eliminate all of them at once, or the wild animals will multiply around you. But the Lord your God will deliver them over to you, throwing them into great confusion until they are destroyed. He will give their kings into your hand, and you will wipe out their names from under heaven. No one will be able to stand up against you. You will destroy them. So how does this relate to the practice of exchanging weapons? Well, we see that God is pledging victory over the land's inhabitants. But he's also pledging protection from what? The wild animals. So we see God's provision of protection here in this covenant. Let's move on to David and Jonathan's covenant. Again, this is a really special covenant to me. It's so detailed and such a beautiful story. I just love the story of it. So let's look at 1 Samuel 18, verses 3 and 4. It says, And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David. Now, we looked at that in our previous session. But we go on to read here that along with his tunic, and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Now, this is a very brief statement in these two verses, and normally it's not necessary to explain it as long as you understand covenants. Again, last week we talked about Jonathan giving up his robe and tunic, which represented his identity. And in this session, we see that he also gave David his weapons for protection, represented his protection, and his belt, which represented his strength, support, and his skills and abilities. Now, in the following passages, we're going to see some of the implications of that in more detail. Let's look at that now, 1 Samuel 19, verses 1 and 2. Remember, Saul had become extremely jealous of David because he was so popular with the people. So in verse 1, we read this, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him. So we see Jonathan protecting David by warning him of danger. If we go now to 1 Samuel 20, verses 1 through 4, we read this, But David fled from Naoth to Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he's trying to take my life? Jonathan replied, Never. You're not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything, great or small, without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so. But David took an oath and said, Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said to himself, Jonathan must not know this or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there is only one step between me and death. Jonathan said to David, Whatever you want me to do, I'll do for you. So what did Jonathan offer to do, and what was the potential cost to him? Jonathan offered to do anything to help David. He risked alienating his own father and endangering himself. So what does this reveal about the strength of covenant bond? It's a covenant is stronger than a king's order, and it's even stronger than a father's expectation. Remember now, Jonathan was the prince. He was the next in line to the throne under his father Saul. So when the king tells you to do something, you don't do it at your own risk. So that's what Jonathan was doing. He was placing himself in jeopardy by standing in David's defense. Let's look now at 1 Samuel 20, verses 30 through 33. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die." Why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him, that is at Jonathan, to kill him. Then Jonathan knew his father intended to kill David. Saul knew that David would become the king. Samuel the prophet had anointed David king, according to 1 Samuel 16. Now Jonathan was standing up to his father to protect David. Again, this is very dangerous for a prince to openly oppose his father, the king. And Saul tried to kill Jonathan, his own son, because Jonathan supported David. So we see the significance here of Jonathan standing in David's defense. Now let's consider God's covenant with David. In Psalm 89, verses 21 to 23, we see God speaking to David. We see what he said recorded here in this passage. And he says this, "My hand will sustain him. Surely my arm will strengthen him. No enemy will subject him to tribute. No wicked man will oppress him. I will crush his foes before him and strike down his adversaries." So how does this relate to the practice of exchanging belts and weapons? Well, we see all aspects of it here. We see strength, we see protection, we see power, and we see victory. So God clearly provided those things in his covenant with David. Now, let's consider the covenant that's most relevant to us today, God's new covenant with Christians. First, let's consider exchanging belts, that is, pledging your strength, support, and abilities and skills. If you look at Ephesians 1:19, you read in part, "And his incomparably great power for us who believe. That power is like the working of his mighty strength." Now look at Ephesians 3:20. "Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us." And then look at Ephesians 6:10. "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power." Now, how do these three verses relate to the practice of exchanging belts? Well, we see in 1:19 that God's power and strength is working for us. In 3:20, we see that he has the ability to do far more than we can even ask or imagine. And in 6:10, we see his power makes us strong. Well, that's why in 2 Corinthians 12:10, Paul wrote, This is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, and in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. So how does this relate to the practice of exchanging belts? From Paul's perspective, he focused on his personal weaknesses because his weaknesses made room for God's strength. You see, as long as I feel strong and capable, I don't feel that I need to rely on God, and I don't even make room for him. Now, he's not going to force himself on me, you know. He's given me a domain, he's given me responsibilities and authority, and he does not intrude on my turf. He won't force himself on me. So if I don't rely on him, he lets me operate on my own. That's a little scary, but that's the way it is. God has pledged to help me and care for me, but only if I rely on him. Now let's consider exchanging weapons, which represented pledging protection. If you look in Romans 5:8, you read this, "But God demonstrates his love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." Now we said earlier that when a covenant partner pledges protection to the other, he pledges protection to his own death, if necessary. And here we see that Jesus Christ gave his life to protect us, from sin and death. Now in Galatians 1:14 we read, in part, who gave himself for our sins to rescue us from the present evil age. But what does it mean that Jesus gave himself? He literally gave his life to help us. That's an expression of his covenant loyalty to us. And what benefit do we receive from his death, according to this verse? Well, he rescued us from evil. That is, he protected us from that which would destroy us. That's his pledge of protection to us, and he followed through on that pledge by giving his own life. Now look at 2 Corinthians 10:3, 4, and 5. For though we lived in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. Well, as seen in this verse, how does the world's concept of weapons differ from God's concept? Well, the world's method of warfare includes using your weapons in combat to inflict injury or death on your enemy. But we wage war differently. You see, our weapons are expressions of our divine authority that God gave us and power. That is, as we exercise our God-given authority, God's power does the work. Now notice the objective is to, in this passage, is to demolish arguments and pretensions that oppose our knowledge of God. I want to point out to you that our enemy, Satan, is already defeated. Now the issue is overcoming our own sinful habits, our sinful attitudes and perspectives and so on. So according to this passage here, it refers to every thought. Whose every thought do we take captive? Our own. And the same is true for the rest of the verse, of the rest of this passage here. We are to demolish our own strongholds. And a stronghold is a way of thinking. And we demolish our own arguments and pretensions, that is, our ideas, that oppose our first-hand knowledge of God. So the emphasis of this passage is the battle we conduct against our own sinful thinking. I contend that the only power Satan has over you is that of persuasion. And one of Satan's tactics is deception, which literally is distracting you from the truth. If he can get you to focus on him, he's accomplished two things. Number one, he's receiving your worship because you're preoccupied with him, and preoccupation is the essence of worship. And secondly, he's distracted you from dealing with your biggest problem, which is your own sinful ways of thinking. So be alert. Wage war mercilessly on every ungodly thought you have. Let's look now at Ephesians 6:17. This is from the Armor of God passage, and it refers to the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. All other parts of armor listed in the Ephesians 6 passage there are either defensive, such as the breastplate, shield, or helmet, or supportive, like the weapon, belt, and shoes. You see, in reality, we don't kill our enemy. Our use of the sword, the only offensive weapon we have in our arsenal here, our use of the sword is strategic. Our enemy is defeated, and we use our sword to limit his work. We are not combat troops. Jesus defeated Satan. We don't have to. And Satan's efforts to engage us in battle are bluff. They're deception. He's defeated, and he knows it. As long as he can keep us misinformed, we'll be distracted from our true mission, which is imposing the victory won by Jesus. Hence our authority. Our authority is not to combat the enemy, but to declare the terms of victory, with the authority commanding the defeated enemy to submit to the will of the victor. The victory is already won. Remember now, Jesus said, "It is finished." And when he says, "It is finished," it is finished. The victory has been won, and we are in a position of imposing or enforcing the terms of the victory. Let me deal with a related point here. If we consider Matthew 5:44, we read, "But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." And in Romans 12:19 and 20, it reads, "Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge. I will repay,' says the Lord. Now, on the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink." So how do these passages relate to the covenant protection, which was represented by exchanging weapons? We don't have to protect ourselves from those who would harm us. The natural or sinful reaction is to defend yourself, to counterattack those who threaten you, to hate those who harm you, and to seek revenge. But can you see that the commands in these verses are not only meaningful, are only meaningful in the context of covenant protection? God pledges to protect us. And because of that, we're to do two things. Number one, we're to rely on Him to protect us. He said He would, so we need to rely on Him to do it. And secondly, we need to put to death our own self-centered attitudes that insist we protect ourselves. This is the only way we can love our enemies and provide for their needs, if we trust God to protect us as He said He would. So how can I forgive when somebody harms me? I trust God to take care of me. It's not up to me to get back at them. Instead of protecting myself, I trust God to do that, and I put to death my own self-centered attitudes that insist that I protect myself. Well, we've seen in this covenant element that God pledges protection and strength and support and skills and abilities. Now, that's great, because God has a whole lot more to offer than we do. But covenants are bidirectional. They work both ways. So our covenant with God requires that we offer all of our strength, support, and skills and abilities to serve Him. It's not that He needs our help, because He's totally complete in Himself. Rather, because we are in covenant relationship with Him, He pledges to us, and we in turn pledge to Him. Now, let's look at God's future new covenant with Israel. This is the covenant that God will make with Israel when Jesus returns to set up His kingdom here on the earth. And we see a brief description of that in Jeremiah 32. Let's look at verse 37 in that chapter. I will surely gather them from all the lands where I banished them in my furious anger and great wrath. I will bring them back to this place and let them live in safety. I just briefly want to point out here that God is pledging protection so that they can live in safety. Again, that's a covenant element, and when God makes this new covenant, protection will be a part of it. And let's consider the marriage covenant. In Ephesians 5:25, we read this, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her." So what is the standard for a husband loving his wife according to this verse? The standard is the same way Christ loved the church. So how did Jesus give Himself up for the church? Well, for one thing, He lived a sinless life. He voluntarily died a horrible death for the church's benefit. So we should consider this as a model for a husband loving his wife, sacrificing himself for her protection, and for her benefit. Now let's look at a little bit later in that same chapter, Ephesians 5, verses 28 and 29. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it just as Christ does the church. So what does it mean for a husband to love his wife as his own body? It says, he who loves his wife loves himself. So be just as diligent in caring for your wife, for the husband caring for his wife, as he is about caring for himself. So how can a husband feed and care for his wife as Christ does the church? In the same way, caring for his wife just as he would for himself, laying down his life for her protection, provision, for her benefit. Now, ladies, these verses happen to emphasize the husband's responsibilities, but I want to remind you that covenants are bidirectional in relationship. So you each, both of you, husband and wife, pledge in covenant to protect, strengthen, support each other, and to use your abilities to benefit the other. So in closing, just let me point out that today we discussed the practice of exchanging belts and weapons. And this represented pledging of protection and strength, support, and skills and abilities. In closing, I'd like to pronounce a blessing over you. May you experience the sheer joy of offering all your strength, support, and abilities to God in exchange for His.